You are listening to the Plastic Surgery Revolution with Dr. Stephen Davis, the one and only podcast that discusses modern plastic surgery and leaves you looking great and feeling better.
Welcome, everyone, to the Plastic Surgery Revolution. I'm your host, Dr. Stephen Davis. Today, we are very, very lucky because we happen to have a phenomenal guest. This is Dr. Mustafa Murad. And let me just give you a little bit of his bio because it's pretty extensive and we're going to have so many things that we're going to be able to talk about. But this gentleman, just to give you some info about who we are going to really get into talking about, he's a double board certified head and neck surgeon and also a facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He is in private practice in New York on 61st and Park Avenue, and he's also the chief of otorhinolaryngology and head and neck surgery at Jamaica Hospital in New York. Welcome to the show, Dr. Murad. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
We're going to have a very good time. We have so many things that we could talk about because your extensive training really gets into so many things. We may even have to break this up into a couple of different podcasts. But for today, I really wanted to start off with you having a really varied, very eclectic practice. I wanted to know, how has the pandemic kind of impacted the 61st and Park Avenue practice as opposed to the one in Jamaica, Queens kind of practice, and the different things that you've been doing to stay, you know, safe and keep everybody still having surgery and still doing your practice?
So, right, the pandemic kind of hit everybody, especially here in New York City, in the tri-state area, pretty hard. No one has to tell you that the numbers are going crazy. And we shut down pretty early, probably in early March, if I remember. And, you know, very shortly after the shutdown, there was a moratorium on elective cases, you know, and the health systems here just became completely stressed. So me and, you know, fellow surgeons kind of felt that impact in all aspects of our practices, specifically at the Manhattan practice. I mean, I shut my doors down. Early on, we had no idea how things were going to play out, you know, how contagious this was. And, you know, I didn't feel like it was worth the risk to put patients at risk, you know, to be seeing patients when we really didn't know what we were dealing with. So very early on, you know, right when the shutdown happened, you know, I shut down the doors, you know, sent the staff home really to try and figure out what would be the safest way to kind of transition back into practice and really just listen to the experts. So we went from, you know, high volume to no volume pretty much overnight. And then when the moratorium hit, I stopped all surgeries up until June 8th.
Right. How about the practice at the Jamaica Hospital? Were you able to still do any, I guess, reconstructive things or any kind of trauma? Or did that actually not really get involved with that until June 8th either?
No. So that part of the practice actually, so Jamaica and Queens in general were probably the hardest hit areas in all of New York.
Yeah.
So the hospitals were completely stressed. You know, Jamaica Hospital, you know, we were at 100% capacity very early on. And we were completely stressed in terms of resources, space. You know, we were turning, you know, every corner into an ICU, ventilated bed. But a major part of my practice is, you know, cancer related surgery. So as far as all elective related type surgeries, we pulled the plug on that. But I did have patients that had cancer, active cancer, required surgical treatment for cancer. And I maintained, you know, those type of that surgical volume. So, you know, we did it on an urgent basis. So, you know, somebody with an advanced stage cancer that, you know, could not wait for, you know, for the moratorium to get lifted, I definitely proceeded without, but purely elective surgeries also were shut down.
So this is a great segue because I really want the audience to realize that the training that you have and the expertise in treating cancer-related type problems, and just from the whole reconstruction of that area of the face, head, and neck region is so intricate, and it's really involved so many years of training with microsurgical techniques and things. Can you tell the audience how that kind of training really gears you up to be such an expert in aesthetic type of surgeries as well?
So that's an interesting point, and it's something we discuss a lot with colleagues and patients. And, you know, the breadth of facial plastics, or even just plastic surgery in general, includes a lot of what we call reconstructive things, you know, on the functional reconstructive side, and aesthetics. And it's really, you know, plastic surgery as a field is very wide. But, you know, when it comes down to it, a lot of people will focus their interest either from a reconstructive standpoint or from an aesthetic standpoint. And you'll see a lot of plastic surgeons in their career will branch off one way or another, depending on their interests. From my standpoint, I've always been interested in all aspects. And a big question I get from a lot of patients and, you know, colleagues is, you know, if you're not so focused in one area, how does it kind of help you? How do you become a better surgeon?
It's a good question.
And the answer is, you know, the training of a surgeon is a very interesting thing. You know, we go through this training. It's a long process. You know, you're learning, you know, a wide variety of surgical techniques and skills, to the point that, you know, and you need to learn all these things, even if you want to hone your skills, you know, in a certain niche area. But I feel like when you're well versed in even the aesthetic side, or well versed in the reconstructive side, you learn a lot of skills that kind of are complementary to each other, and you keep those skill set very active and strong, as opposed to focusing in one niche area. So I find that, you know, as a surgeon who's trained in a wide variety of things, the reason is that you train in those wide variety of things so that you can translate those skills into various technical aspects of your practice. So being, when you're considering a patient from an aesthetic standpoint, to be functionally in reconstructive thinking, you can provide, from my standpoint, I believe, a better outcome. You know, function and aesthetics go hand in hand. You don't, yep, for example, do a rhinoplasty and think about how the nose is going to look if you don't really consider how the nose is going to function.
Absolutely.
You know, so yep. I tell my patients, you know, if I could build a nose from scratch, then I can, you know, take down a hump and make it aesthetically look better, you know, just because those principles, they're not exclusive. They're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. I remember in my training very, very, very early on, my trainers used to always talk that form and function in the world of plastic surgery go hand in hand. It wasn't like one versus the other. And you segued beautifully into rhinoplasty, because out of all the aesthetic cosmetic procedures that are out there, that may be one of the ones that really, you have to really function, you know, you have to be able to breathe well, even if that nose looks amazingly great. If you've done anything on the inside to create a lot of scar tissue, mm-hmm, and make it like the patient becomes a, you know, a nasal cripple, even though it may look great, they're going to be a very, very unhappy patient. So you're absolutely right. Going through all those years of training to make sure that you understand the form and function is terrific. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was looking through your bio, and one of the topics that you wrote a really wonderful paper along with some other colleagues was about the adjuncts of other aesthetic procedures that can be teamed up with rhinoplasty. And I just wondered if you could, you know, tell the audience about some of those things that you may feel is like a really common thing that you would do, let's say, simultaneously with the rhinoplasty, or what you really think kind of go hand in hand with trying to make that nose look terrific.
So yeah, the nose is, you know, the centerpiece to the face. It really does, can distract from the rest of the face, or really can be harmonious with the rest of the face. So, you know, one of the things that a surgeon, you know, like yourself, or a plastic surgeon, really has to consider when they're evaluating a patient is, how does the nose fit with the harmony of the rest of the face. And a lot of times patients don't even understand this principle. You know, how does my nose fit with the rest? And there's certain proportions, you know, the width of your nose in relation to your eyes, how far your nose comes out in relation to your chin. You really have to consider the general picture of a person's face when you're even just hyper focusing on altering or shaping the nose in a way or another. So me and my colleagues really wanted to create a, you know, surgeons love algorithms. You know, you're a surgeon. Everybody, you know, loves to put things pen to paper and you know, have like a very systematic way of looking at, you know, problems and solving problems. And this is what we all innately do, you know, and with years of experience, you'll find that people, you know, surgeons will do this kind of subconsciously on a level. But what we wanted to do is put, you know, put pen to paper and really come up with the, you know, an algorithmic approach to how you would, you know, determine, you know, what is needed in addition to a rhinoplasty. You know, if a patient comes in and they're like, I just want my nose shorter, where is it really that their nose needs to be shorter or does their chin need to come out a little bit more?
Right.
You know, so some of the things you consider is, you know, chin projection, cheek projection, you know, if they have, you know, deep forehead wrinkles, because these are all things that can be altered in addition to a rhinoplasty. But what ends up happening is you might end up doing, you know, a less invasive rhinoplasty if you're able to, you know, consider the harmonious aesthetics of the remainder of the face, which is, you know, important. But because rhinoplasty is probably, I would say, the second most prevalent surgery after breast augmentation in the United States. So people are getting this surgery a lot. So it's really important to, you know, consider just not just rhinoplasty, but, you know, the rest of the face.
So Dr. Morad, could you take us through like a common rhinoplasty consultation? Because I'm curious to hear, and I know my audience is going to be very interested to hear. They showed up at 61st and Park Avenue, and they were coming in specifically for a rhinoplasty. Take us through how that kind of consultation works.
So, you know, then this becomes the marriage of function and form. Each of my consultations, and, you know, if my patients are out there and listening, they'll know that initial consultation probably takes about an hour. I spend a long time with my patients trying to really understand what it is that bothers them. But I always start with function, you know, breathing. You know, is it one side or another? Have you had any trauma? I really try and get to understand, you know, how the nose functions. I ask about things like allergies, sinus infections, to really, you know, get an understanding of, you know, if I operate on this nose, you know, are there other factors at play that will impact the function? Once we get past the kind of function, I ask the patient from a cosmetic standpoint, what is it about your nose that you don't like? And it's funny because, you know, a lot of patients will be like, well, you tell me, and I will never tell a patient what's wrong with their nose. That's, you know, that's a problem. And, you know, because if it doesn't bother them, it doesn't bother me.
So that's right. That's like plastic surgery 101.
Right, exactly.
Like you really want them to explain to you what, I got you.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, I ask what, you know, in their own words, and, you know, I'll literally write down, you know, word for word what they say. Oh, I don't like this bump. Oh, my nose is too long. Oh, it droops when I smile. Then I'll take them through a professional series of photographs. And then I will sit down with them, you know, with the computer, and I'll tell them, listen, let's look at the front view. So I'll go through the different views. I'll be like, what don't you like in this front view? And I'll have them point out to it. And then we'll look at profile views, oblique views, and, you know, just the different views. And they can, you know, literally tell me what it is specifically that they don't like. And then once I have an idea of, from a functional and aesthetic, what the problem is, I basically break down the surgery for them. I have, I'll go through and I will show them what the internal structure of the nose is. I'll translate for them, you know, what a bump looks like to them, to what it looks like on the inside of the nose. And I come up with the surgical plan with them in place in real time with them, and I'll write it on a diagram. So what begins to happen is the patients become like little, it's like a mini fellowship in surgery. They begin to understand the inner anatomy of the nose. They understand, you know, where the bones are, where the cartilages are, you know, if this cartilage is misplaced in one way or another, and they begin to understand the surgical plan through my eyes. So it's kind of funny. I first try and understand the problem through their eyes, and the consultation ends with them seeing the solution solution through my eyes.
That's really wonderfully said. I really, really like that a lot. That's terrific. Yeah. Now, let me ask you a question. If during this consultation, they're explaining everything about the nose that they don't like, and you want to educate them that they may have some microgenia, they may have a chin that's kind of short, or they may just have some retronathism, meaning that, you know, for everyone listening out there, that the chin is just not protruding to the distance that it should, or maybe a small chin. How do you kind of enlighten them to that, so that a chin implant or something like that may also be something that would make a more harmonious, as you said, result?
Well, that's a really good question. How do you kind of, you know, they're telling you one problem and they're focusing on one thing. How do you kind of redirect them? And I just do it the same way I would, you know, sitting down with another surgeon or somebody and just basically go through the measurements. You know, if one of their problems in, you know, for the listeners out there, a lot of people would say their nose is too long or too big. And what's really happening is it's an optical illusion because their chin's too small. So I'll go through and actually draw on the diagram or, you know, measure out and say, well, actually, your nose isn't too big. You know, if you look at where your chin should be, and I'll show them, you know, schematics and, you know, some standard diagrams. And I'll say, well, if you see, you know, the plane where your chin is, you could see it's a little bit behind, which gives an optical illusion of your nose being too big. And what happens is if I shorten their nose without giving them projection on their chin, it's not going to look good. It's going to look very strange. And it still might look like their nose is too big, or you're going to have to overcompensate for the small chin by, you know, over shortening the nose, which might be a little more invasive. So I would tell them, listen, you might not even need an invasive shortening of the nose. You just need a little bit of chin projection. And, you know, I'll do that with any measurements, you know, I'll show them the width of their nose in relation to the width of their eyes, you know, but really I find that sitting down with them and showing them what I see, really becomes a good communication tool. You know, some other people might just say, no, it's just your chin that's too small. Let's put in a chin implant. Well, you know, if they don't understand why the chin implant's going in, they might just think you're trying to sell them a chin implant. Right. But if there's sound science and you can communicate effectively with the patient, I find that they're more amenable to that adjunct procedure.
Very well said. I agree with you 100%. Going along with around the mouth and around the nose, one of the surgeries, and I'm just curious to know from your perspective, because I know around my area, again, it's not that far away. We're all in that tri-state kind of area. But one of the procedures that has taken off, it's not a brand new procedure, but one of the ones that in my practice I've done more of in the last, I'd say, 2 years than I have done, you know, I've been in practice over 25 years. I'm going to say the last 2 years, this has had a resurgence. And the operation is a lip lift. And for everyone listening out there, a lot of women, as they get older, start to get a lengthening of their upper lip from where the bottom of their nose is to where the red lip would start. And that whole white lip area starts to get longer and longer. And one of the problems, again, is that the red lip starts to turn under. So a lot of women will just come in for lip fillers, which is fine. But many times it really doesn't solve the problem of that lengthening of the upper lip. So one of the procedures that has been around for a very long time is a lip lift, where we make an incision right underneath the base of the nose and very elegantly steal away a little bit of skin from that area so that we're shortening that distance. And the reason why I'm bringing that up with Dr. Murad is that another one of your specialties and things that you've really been expert in, even writing a paper about, is the management of facial scars. And one of the reasons why some people are skeptical or even a little afraid of having that operation is that there will be a permanent scar right at the sill or the base of the nose. And just making sure that they understand that and that things that we could do to make that scar look amazing. So take it away, Dr. Murad. I want to just ask you that.
Yeah, no, that's definitely an interesting thing. The lip lift and the, you know, tons of lip lifts. It's all over social media. Surgeons are doing it. It's been around for a while, but for some reason in the past couple of years, and I don't know if this is a product of, you know, social media or just greater public awareness of the procedure and its availability, is this lip lift. And listen, I agree with the problem that the lip lift addresses. You know, the lengthening of that, you know, upper lip really does have a dramatic aesthetic impact on patients. When they smile, they can't see their teeth. It really impacts how their smile looks. It gives an aged look to the periorbital area. So the lip lift really does address and rejuvenate kind of that upper lip area and gives it a little bit of fullness, especially if you do it with fillers. But yeah, the big drawback is the scar. And, you know, a lot of people don't really understand that you can't cut the skin without leaving a scar. You know, you can close it as perfectly as possible. And, you know, everybody's capable of like giving the best plastics closure, but ultimately there's going to be a scar. And there's a lot of unpredictability, I think, for many different patients and how they will scar. And that lip lift scar is in a very prominent, visible area. So what ends up happening is that, you know, it's you're getting a rejuvenated kind of perioral area at the cost of a scar. And, you know, in my practice, in my opinion, I think, you know, I'm a little more selective in terms of who I would offer the lip lift to. You know, older patients with wrinkles, undergoing other procedures like a facelift. Women, I think, are good candidates because they can kind of conceal a lot of that scarring with makeup, you know, but I see a big push, and I don't know, you know, your opinion, but a lot of younger women in their 20s and 30s are actually undergoing this lip lift, which is, you know, in you know, that can definitely lead to some noticeable scarring. And what I tell patients is like, listen, you know, I'll give you the Park Avenue plastics closure, but right. ultimately, you know, two important things, you know, lend themselves to how well you will scar. One is your own body, you know, how well it goes through the inflammatory process and how well it can heal itself. But number two is that post-operative care. You know, you want to keep the incisions clean. You want to keep the crust and the clot out. You want to keep it nice and moist. Because if any crust or old blood gets in there, well, bacteria gets in there, the incisions lines open up and it widens that scar. And it definitely will impact, you know, the aesthetics of that and outcome. And that really, that kind of post-operative, you know, scar treatment, I would say is, you know, for the first 3 weeks after a surgery. Then after that, you know, then you can get into kind of the things to kind of enhance it, you know, things like silicone-based treatments, steroid treatments, some of the, you know, injectable and topical chemotherapy agents.
Let me ask you, so with facial scars or scars in general, if everything's healing well, so let's say it is the lip lift or a facelift, and the scars really are healing beautifully, is there any product in particular or topical agent that you feel has enough literature or something behind it to recommend that your patients use, let's say, on a facelift incision that's healing very well? Nothing, you know, there was no post-operative infection. There's no problems. Nothing's healing in like a hypertrophic fashion. But I'm saying just for like nourishing the scar and making sure that it will continue to heal the best that it can, what's kind of like your regimen of how to make these facial scars end up looking the best?
The best, yeah. No, the first thing is I tell them, listen, once you're past the post-operative period after that 3 weeks, I tell them sunscreen. So you don't want, you know, any enhanced inflammation from, you know, and color discoloration from, you know, sun exposure. So I tell them if you're going out in the sun, definitely keep it covered. As far as what the scientific literature shows, you know, and this is what's kind of sad about plastic surgery is our literature is never as good as we wish it was. but I tell them, you know, I would say silicone-based ointments.
Yeah, that's what we use too. Same thing.
A lot of scar, like the silicone base. The literature is going to be very, you know, touch and go. It's varied in terms of what you'll find based on what study. But, you know, from, and I think, you know, from talking to colleagues like yourself, it's very anecdotal. Like people will say that the silicone-based stuff does work. I usually recommend that. And, you know, if they heal well, great. And at 6 to 8 months, if, you know, there's a little bit of redness, raisedness, then, you know, we talk about, you know, dermabrasion or some of the resurfacing, depending on where the scar is, if it hides, but really to get that, the best possible outcome, I think it's one is wound care, two is the sunscreen, and then three in the final, stretches, the silicone-based ointments.
So I got to tell you a couple of things that I've been doing that, again, I found that it really seems to make a difference. So I don't know if you're doing like any laser resurfacings on the face, possibly after a facelift or something like that. But one of the things that I've started to do more and more is if I'm doing a facelift and I'm, let's say, going to do a laser resurfacing of the perioral lines or let's say under the eyes, I'll wait a couple of weeks after the facelift and doing the resurfacing around the mouth or around the eyes, I'll do. And I'll sometimes back off the energy from some of the lasering, and I actually will laser very gently the incisions from the facelift and things. And again, I don't have any studies that I've done, but like prophylactically going into that, and even sometimes when I'm doing some Botox injections around the time of the facelift or the blepharoplasty or something like that, some Botox around the incisions seems to be helping, so there's not like tension on the repair. I know, I don't know, with for everyone listening, when we're talking about doing brow lifts and things like that, many times I'll do the Botox injection about 2 weeks before a brow lift. I don't know about you, Dr. Morad, if you like that idea, but I started doing that maybe about 5 years ago, and I felt that it during the healing phase of the brow lift, if I could really, you know, stop those depressor muscles from pulling against my lifting repair. I don't know. Again, the results have been very nice. I don't know if you're in agreement with doing something like that, but some of these ancillary little tricks, I know I found for from scar, not even scar treatment. It's more just like as a preempting of anything. I don't know. It's just something I've been throwing into the mix.
No, I think those are great adjuncts. I mean, that's exactly it. You want, you know, and I think staging it, I think that's kind of key is, you know, and it seems like you run like a very, you know, boutique personal practice where you spend time with your patients that you can stage things like that. Yeah. And I think that's important is to go to a surgeon that's really going to take their time, not really do the resurfacing at the same time as a facelift and kind of be done with it, you know, to be able to bring them back, you know, a couple weeks later, do the resurfacing, you know, really address the scars. It really means that you're taking your time with your patients. And that's the kind of thing that ultimately leads to the best outcomes is, you know, really kind of going gradually, making sure that, you know, you're providing the right services at the right time to really maximize their benefit. But I 100% agree. I think, you know, Botox, resurfacing, those things are great as adjuncts.
Right. And that's why one of the reasons why I really wanted to have you, Dr. Morad, on the program is because I do think, you know, having that practice on 61st and Park Avenue in, you know, in New York is a boutique practice in itself. And I think, you know, being able to really make sure that the patients know that you're really doing everything you can to give them the very, very best outcome for everything that they've come in to really talk to you about, I think is the key. And just like you just said, you know, aside from just the hand holding and making sure that they know that you're really, you know, making this into an experience as opposed to just a surgery, I think in this day and age is such a key factor in people just feeling better about themselves. And I know there's so many patients that have been coming in that are working from home, that are doing everything on Zoom calls and things like that. And they really do get a chance. You know, I'm sure you hear this all the time. to see themselves for the first time, maybe in so many different meetings, because they're looking at themselves on the screen and they go, my God, I can't believe my neck looks like that. Or I can't believe, you know, I have so many furrows in my brow or something. And they do come in to have these things done. And because they are working from home and they don't have to maybe travel anywhere, they're into getting a lot of these procedures done. And I'm positive that everyone that's listening really gets the sense, especially from you, about how important it is to really individualize and make this treatment such a boutique kind of a practice. So I think it's really interesting to hear you talk about it.
No, it's I think you hit it. It's when you're doing plastic surgery, it's not just a service, it's an experience. You know, you want to get to know your patients. You really need to know what it is that bothers them. And you really need to take them through the process beginning to end, you know, at their pace. It is an experience. And, you know, I really enjoy it. And I think that's kind of one of the benefits of doing, you know, aesthetic and cosmetic surgery is you really get to know these patients and really get to help them out and change their lives.
Well, any last final words about anything that you wanted to make sure that the audience heard?
No, I mean, I just wish everybody would stay safe and healthy during this COVID pandemic. And, you know, it's kind of been a rough few months, but hopefully we'll pull through. Yeah.
Well, I just want everybody to know that I've really, really enjoyed having you on the program, Dr. Murad, because I think the empathy that you need to have being a head and neck surgeon and doing so much cancer reconstruction definitely filters into your ability to be that kind and that great of a person when you're doing aesthetic type surgery. So I think everyone that's listening, this is a really marriage of having the empathy of like taking care of really serious medical things like a cancer reconstruction. And at the same time, understanding that people coming in that really want to feel better about themselves may have that same kind of genuine feeling that you really do want to go to someone that has that empathy. And Dr. Mustafa Murad, I am very, very, very excited that we've had a chance to meet like this. I have a feeling that we're going to be doing another one of these podcasts one day soon because I have a million other questions that I want to ask you about things that you do that I no longer do some of this microvascular reconstruction type stuff. And I do want to get into a few of those things and how it kind of gets into the intricacies and the preciseness that you have to have and how you find that to tie into so much aesthetic surgery. But for everyone out there, you've been listening to the Plastic Surgery Revolution. Today's guest was Mustafa Murad from New York City. Dr. Murad, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Goodbye, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Plastic Surgery Revolution with Dr. Stephen Davis. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. Keep listening, looking great, and feeling better.